Join me as I highlight small businesses in the craft industry with interviews on-site at distilleries, breweries, and more. This podcast is all about getting to know the people behind the craft, celebrating their hard work, and of course, having a few samples along the way. Welcome to Crafted Conversations. All right, well, Jeff, we're here at St. Froid Distilling in Hyattsville, Maryland.
Yep.
First time here, and I found you online because I've been doing this, you know, tour of distilleries around the area that I live while I can. And you have a cool little operation here. I want to know more about it. So tell me about yourself and how you got into this business.
Sure. So my brother-in-law, Nate Grunendijk, and I started this about 7 years ago. The business itself and a lot of that first couple of years was just planning what we wanted to do, how we wanted to do it. Once we found this space, this is a very unique space. It's on a commercial strip and what's called the Arts District of Hyattsville. And so it's unique in that it's zoned for brewing, distilling, winemaking, cider making, mead making. And it's kind of this nice little neighborhood here where we've got a meadery down the road, a Defone brewery less than a quarter mile away, a brew pub right across the street. So this was a great place for us, and we thought this would be just a nice community. I only live 10 minutes away. My brother-in-law lives 3 minutes away.
Wow.
So it made a lot of sense for us. What got us into the idea of distilling, I think, was getting exposed to really, really good spirits. In particular, apple brandy from France, Calvados. And we had our first taste of Calvados probably 10 years or so ago. And there was nothing else in the market like it at the time. And it kind of planted that seed for us that, you know, that's the kind of thing that we want to do, that we want to make. And actually, before any of the planning for the distillery happened, we were starting to graft apple trees and looking for land so that we could grow an orchard with particular varieties of apples and other fruit that we know will make either good cider or good brandy.
Sure.
So that was kind of the first step, and taking over my tiny little eighth of an acre front yard with a nursery of, I think, 400 trees that we grafted over the first 2 years. My wife was ecstatic about that. And then that was the first step, planning the distillery, finding the location, building it out, getting all the equipment. That was the next step about 6 or 7 years ago. And we opened our doors in December of 2018 here in Hyattsville. And at the time, we only had two spirits, a Dutch style gin, and we can talk more about what exactly that means, and a pear brandy, our very first year too.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, and I appreciate you having me here. I mean, you have a small, you have a small space. It's quaint and it works. And you were showing me around before we got on the mic that, you know, you're making the most of your space. I love that. I love that craft. You kind of put your blood, sweat, and tears in it. You're just telling me too, you're moving barrels by yourself with your hands.
Yes. Yes. getting older, it's not as easy as it was 5 years ago. But yeah, we have what we like to call a humble little distillery. It's cozy.
Yeah.
We have about 1,000 square feet, and maybe half of that is production space. So we have to do everything we can to maximize that space. And we play a lot of Tetris in here with our pallet jack moving things around so that we can negotiate our way. But we've made it work.
Yeah, I love it. And were you? I know you said you found love with that French brandy. But were you a whiskey connoisseur, gin, a spirits person, a cocktail person growing up? Or was it like you just kind of fell onto that when you started? Do you like to drink?
It's a long meandering story. I'll try and draw as straight a line between the points as I can. So Nate is my brother-in-law. Our wives are sisters. And they have another brother-in-law who makes cider and goat cheese in Vermont. And so he was the one who introduced us to really good wine, a really good cider and Calvados. And when you've had something that you just immediately know is so much superior to everything you've had before, it kind of changes you. And it really just opened up for us what's possible and what's missing. There's a long history of growing apples to make cider and brandy in the US and in other parts of the world. But that kind of died out after Prohibition for a variety of reasons. In particular, on the East Coast, it died out. And so that exposure to something excellent made us want to make something that excellent ourselves. It's kind of the philosophy that drives all of our approaches to spirits, whether that's our whiskeys, our gins, but certainly our brandies. We want to take the best stuff we can find and make the best stuff out of that. So we really think about what's happening in the orchard 10 years ago to make apples that we use today. And it's the same kind of philosophical approach to all of our spirits. We were never big whiskey connoisseurs. We were aware of kind of what the craft distilling market was at and what it was producing back when we first started this idea. And there's been an incredible amount of growth and evolution for the good in craft spirits, in particular around the DC area. We've got a ton of really good small craft distilleries making top-notch stuff.
Yeah.
And we think that's great. Yeah. One of the things that we researched when we were opening this was, you know, just a history of some of the distilleries in Maryland, but also nationally, pre-Prohibition or even, you know, even World War II era, thousands of distilleries, thousands. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, before the big boom, or I guess the first boom in craft distilling, there were, you know, a dozen distilleries nationwide and probably, you know, more like four or five that were making 99% of the stuff that you could buy.
Right.
Yeah. And we certainly saw a niche for what we do. But it wasn't because we were connoisseurs of spirits. It was more that we thought we could do something well and make something that just wasn't really out there.
Yeah, well, I love that. Well, that's the whole point why I'm doing this, why I'm talking to you. I enjoy those stories of people who are making these craft, you know, products that, you know, I keep shitting on the big guys. And I shouldn't do that. Sponsor me. But there's a lot less tender, loving care that goes into that. You see a bottle of white labeled Jim Beam everywhere, but you come and have this and you have a story and you have this, this ragtag. And you source the materials yourself. You use the materials yourself. Your hands are on it.
Yeah, you know, I see the art in those large producers in the systems engineering and the consistency that sure. they're able to achieve. Like that's something I will never be able to do on this scale, and don't want to either. Right. I was doing some rye mashes this week, and we had a really, really wet spring and a wet fall last year too. So the grains are significantly different from, you know, the small 10-acre farm that is growing some of our rye and spelt and other grains that we use. You know, there's a tremendous variation season to season, year to year, even if otherwise the growing conditions are, you know, more or less identical, or the approach to growing is identical. So, you know, we're not attempting to achieve the same consistency over time. What we are trying to do is attempt to maintain the same level of quality over
right.
time. And that will be different even though, or the quality will be the same, even though the end product will be different.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Well, as far as distillation goes, was that a learned process for you guys? Did you just kind of wade into it and like, all right, we're going to try this. And then was it a trial and error of like, oh God, this sucks for the first 2 years.
So, we had been home brewers for a long time, my brother-in-law
okay.
and I.
Okay.
And you know, that from our experience is the most difficult part of making a good spirit is understanding fermentation and having a good fermentation and not destroying the raw ingredients that you're using. We had also started making cider about 10, 12 years ago too, with the same kind of approach. And you know, at that time and still there's just a dearth of the kinds of apples that make good cider available commercially.
Sure,
so,
sure.
Coming into the distillation coming into exposing ourselves to distillation, you know, we did a course with Cornell in New York. I think that was in 2014 or 2015. It was just a 2-day kind of a hands-on course. Didn't learn a whole lot from that, but not because the course wasn't any good. Nate and I just read everything. Sure. That's you know, both of our background. He's in education. I was in government for a long time. We are voracious consumers of the written word, and so we understood processes. We understood the basics and fundamentals of how to take a wine, a cider, a beer, and distill it. The real learning curve for us was understanding the differences in the types of spirits that we make and how they're different coming across the still. For instance, the fruit brandies in particular, you have to pay attention throughout the run because there are very significant differences in flavor as you're approaching the tails cuts, and if I'm saying anything that's not making any sense, it's basically towards the end of the run, there right. can be some really big fluctuations in flavors that are coming across the still. Whereas with our grain-based spirits, our whiskeys and gins, it's pretty much a straight line once we know when we're starting to collect the hearts, the good stuff that we're gonna keep in bottle. It's a straight line until we get to the tails, and we know more or less what that's gonna look like every single time. But every year the fruit is different because there's just such a variation in tree fruit more so than grains.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's one thing I haven't really talked to people too much about is it's mostly been grains and obviously selfishly I'm more of a whiskey person to begin with.
I won't judge.
No, but I love brandy too. But I would assume that different varietals and fruit and different fruits from day to day would give you such
absolutely
much yep. more inconsistency yep. to work with.
Yeah, not to steal from the wine jargon, but terroir
yeah.
from fruit is a much more measurable and noticeable part of the process than grains. And even, you know, our grains do, I think, certainly have some terroir, but the fruit is just it's a different animal.
Yeah. Do you think that adds to the fun for you of just of you know, forcing that square peg in the round hole of like, I'm gonna make this work and it's gonna be good?
It does. It also adds a layer of complexity yeah. and risk. It's fruit is also much more expensive than grains. So it's a much higher stakes process to go from raw fruit to a brandy in a bottle than it is for grains. One of our approaches with fruit, and we've been like this from day one, is that we don't add any yeast, we don't add any sulfites, we process the fruit and let the natural yeast, any ambient yeast, do the job of fermentation.
Wow.
And that's always a risk because if there's any infection, there goes the batch.
Yeah.
But you know, knock on wood, so far we have not lost a single batch of fermenting fruit. We've been able to, now in year five of fruit harvest, we've had no problems with fermentation.
Is this something that you strive to do from the beginning, or yep. did you try yeast first, or?
Yeah, no, it was something that we tried to do from the beginning, and a lot of that influence comes from French cider making, French brandy making.
Okay, yep. Gotcha, which yeah. I know nothing about. So
I've got a big, thick book somewhere where I can, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I know, and jumping over to the grain, before we got on the mic too, you were telling me that you don't use any corn.
Right.
Which is unique for a place that makes whiskey. So tell me about that. What was the decision process for that?
So everyone agrees that Maryland rye whiskey was a thing. It was an historically important spirit to the state of Maryland, and the region too. Monongahela rye, rye grows pretty much everywhere, and it grows really well in the Mid-Atlantic, even in a humid environment. There's less agreement about what Maryland rye was. You can find some documentation of the Eastern Shore distilleries having a much higher proportion of corn in their rye whiskeys. Western Maryland whiskeys, probably much less corn, more barley. And we kind of settled on, it's about a 2/3 to 1/3 malted or rye to malted barley ratio. What the malted barley does provides a little bit of sweetness, but it also helps convert the starches in rye into sugar. So malted rye has a couple of enzymes that when you get them to a certain temperature, they're activated and they take these long chain starches in rye and cut them up into sugar. So So we knew we needed to have malted barley. Other distilleries, you can just buy these enzymes and dump them in there. But again, not our approach. And for us, the corn wasn't as big of a part of the recipe. And also just from a functional standpoint, our equipment can't make corn. Corn needs to be heated up to a higher temperature than malted barley and rye to act or convert those starches into fermentable sugars. Sure. So it's not to say that we won't do a bourbon someday or a corn, a whiskey with some kind of corn component. It would have to be the right corn. We're not just going to get any yellow dent and throw it in there. We would work with our farmers to find something that has some kind of historic importance to the area or, you know, a highly flavorful heirloom grain. That's kind of our approach to all of our grains. So
no, that's awesome. And I mean, it should just reason because I don't like bourbon, so I don't want to put corn.
Oh, we love bourbon. Bourbon's great. But there, everyone has a bourbon, and unless we can say something with our bourbon, I know it'll be good. But I want to be able to say something with it. And you know, we'll figure out what that is.
Yeah.
And it will be in our future, but not yet. We haven't produced any yet.
That's fair. What about the aging process? So I know I saw some barrels back there. Was that a learned experience where it's like, was that sweet spot for what makes it taste good? Or
So we use smaller barrels. We use 15-gallon barrels. That's about what I can carry when they're full. And for the whiskeys, they're charred number 4, new oak. Because they're smaller and our aging is outside, so it's exposed to temperature changes. The aging process is a little bit more accelerated than if we were in a temperature controlled warehouse or if they were underground in caves or something similar to how they're aged in parts of Normandy in France. We knew we had something good. The very first spirit that we put into a barrel was a gin. And our gins, I mentioned Dutch style. The long and short of it is, it's almost like an unaged whiskey that's flavored with botanicals, as opposed to the London dry style, which is essentially a base spirit that's neutral vodka that's flavored with botanicals. So the Dutch style, and we do what would be considered an oude jenever, an old Dutch style, and there's just a higher proportion of essentially whiskey in the base. And it has a similar flavor to our rye whiskey. But we knew at 6 months when we tasted it that we had something special. We didn't know exactly what that sweet spot was going to be for when we took stuff out of a barrel.
Sure.
And it's different with each barrel because, you know, sometimes we're filling in the middle of January. Sometimes we're filling in the middle of a hot summer. And the aging process can be a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, depending on how much of that warm season we get. Because we find that we get much more accelerated aging during the summer than we do in the colder months. We wanted to get to 2 years on our rye. It was so good at 12, 15 months. That's kind of our sweet spot with our rye. We really like it. What people would consider young, but we get too much oak in those smaller barrels in the aging style that we have where they're outside exposed to the elements. So yeah, that 12 to 15 months is where we still have a lot of that grain character that comes through and still some of the sweetness from the malted barley and not too much overpowering oak where that just washes out all of the good flavors that we work so hard to get in there.
Right.
With our brandies, right now, the only brandy that we have that's aged is our apple brandy, and we use a French oak that's toasted for those. So you don't get as much extraction from the barrel as you would with the whiskey as quickly. So it's a longer, a little bit slower process. But right now, most of our apple brandies are right around 2 years.
Okay.
If we went to a larger barrel or if we started using used barrels, that could extend to the right. But we think that's pretty good right now. One of the I don't want to say it's a dirty secret, but I think it's a secret. Young Calvados is so much better than older Calvados because you still taste the apple because it's made from a cider that was pressed right outside their orchard. And those are the parts that we want to keep. When you've got a 15, 20, 30-year-old Calvados, you're tasting barrel and maybe a little bit of apple. But for some people, it's indistinguishable from a really old whiskey.
Yeah, I think that's the one perception in the market that I'm hopeful is changing quickly with all these craft distilleries popping up. I mean, wineries and meaderies and everything, that age does not mean better. Sometimes it does.
It depends. Yeah.
But there's a lot of places I've come across where it's a craft operation and they have a cash register to fill. So I can't put this whiskey in for 4 years, but they put a lot of TLC and time and effort and blood, sweat, and tears in the actual base product. That their new make proof down is delicious by itself.
Yeah.
So if you have a good product to begin with, putting it for 15 months in a barrel, have a little extra wood sugar come into it, you're fine. So I love that.
Yeah, we are very careful with our cuts, not just for our unaged spirits that are gonna just be proofed down with water and straight into a barrel or straight into a bottle. We're very careful with our cuts on our whiskeys.
Sure.
Even though, you know, the longer you have something in a barrel that might have a little bit more of the rough edges on either side of the heads of the tails, a barrel can soften that over time. But we're not playing that kind of game. We want to put the best stuff in the barrel, and that's been our approach with aging.
Have you been able to squirrel away any experiments just for funsies to say, hey, you know what?
No, because we run out, and I keep having to empty those barrels.
That's fair.
we have. Two barrels that I think will be really special. I don't know when, but we barreled a pear brandy from this year's harvest and a cherry brandy from last year's cherry harvest.
Ooh.
And hopefully they get better in the barrel and not worse because they're already excellent. and we just had a lot this year and we wanted to kind of take a flyer and see what would happen.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a little risky because these are two spirits that have a very delicate bouquet, and you get fresh fruit from those spirits. So adding the character of the barrel could be good, but could change it in a way that we don't want. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, that's fun. And I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff that you want to try down the road that you have a checklist that
we did put a barrel of single malt out there.
Ah.
It's about a year old now.
Okay.
And it's 100% malted barley that we get from a farm just outside of Frederick. And we're excited to check that one out. The Craft Spirits Modernization Act, I think, is the name of the legislation that passed in 2021 at the federal level, created a new standard of identity for American single malt.
Yep.
And that was part of the influence there to put a single malt away and see what happens.
Yeah, why not? That's so wild that in 2021 we're still naming liquor.
Yeah, it's a highly regulated industry, and for good reason.
Sure.
And things don't change quickly, and there's a process to updating laws, regulations, standards, and hopefully we continue to go in the right direction.
Have you found it? We don't have to go on this tangent too long, but have you found it to be an easy traversal to go through all that permitting and the laws and whatnot, or has it been a little bit of an uphill learned battle?
So my background is kind of in policy, and policy analysis. So felt like I had a pretty good understanding of at least how the rules and regulations are written and where to find them, first of all, and you know, how to comply with them. But it is complicated. There's, you know, regulation at the federal level, the state level, county, city. It's changing all the time. We do work with our guild at the state level to understand legislative changes and push for legislative changes. We used to be part of two national organizations, ACSA and ADI, American Distilling Institute and American Craft Spirits Association. And they do that work at the federal level and advocate for craft distilleries. But yeah, it's complicated, and you know, we're a two-man shop. So we don't have lawyers that we can keep on retainer or pay to do that kind of work for us. So that's one of the other great things about owning a small business is you get to become a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
And master of none, maybe, but but yeah, you know, it's all part of the package.
Well, it's cool too that all these small businesses. I mean, first and foremost, you're a small business, yep. Right?
But very small.
But in the craft distilling, craft brewing, craft everything world, that there's all these guilds and organizations that are. It's like you're not fighting with this craft spirit place down the road.
No,
you guys
no,
are
no.
friends and you're working together. Yes. That's make some cool stuff.
That's absolutely true.
So,
yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, we know our neighbors. We know the other distillery owners in the area. And some who make similar stuff to us nationally, we communicate through social media or online. Yeah. So yeah, there is certainly a community, and it's I hope thriving.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Yeah. COVID had some negative impacts on some small businesses, but for the most part, I think folks around here weathered it okay.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Well, I think we should cheers to that with our first
sample.
Yeah,
let's do it.
Tell me what you got.
All right, so I'm going to start you off with our pear brandy. So this is what we call an eau de vie, water of life, translated from the French. And essentially, it just means an unaged brandy. So all spirits, when they come off the still, they're clear. The color from ours and our whiskeys and our apple brandy, that's all come from the barrel.
Yep.
We get our pears from an orchard in Pennsylvania called Peter's Orchards, just outside of Biglerville. It's a big fruit growing region, close to Gettysburg in Pennsylvania. So it's only about 70 miles away. And we take the pears. They're not ripe when we get them. We wait until they are perfect. You can push your thumb through them. And we grind them, and that kind of creates what looks like applesauce. And then that's how we ferment the pear wine, quote unquote, and then distill that pear mash wine. And this is a double distillation through our alembic pot still. It's a bain marie, which just means it's a water bath, a hot water bath. So it's super gentle, and we can be very careful about coaxing out flavors at different temperatures. And the particular variety of pear, it's Bartlett pear. In Europe, it's known as William's pear, and German-speaking country, William's Vienna. The person who imported that particular variety in the United States, name was Bartlett, got a new name. And it is a pear that just has a very unique characteristic in that it comes across the still as if you're biting into a fresh Bartlett pear. Other pears that we've worked with do not have that same characteristic. So this one is perfectly suited for an eau de vie, as opposed to other types of pears, which might be more suited for time in a barrel.
Yeah, I will say that is a warm hug with a pear flavor that just bursts in your mouth. I love that.
Yeah,
I love pears
great.
Too. I grew up with a pear tree in my yard, and
hey, pears for your heirs. They can live for hundreds of years.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's very good. And I'm curious too, because obviously not many people that I know like to sip brandy neat. Was your intent to put it in a cocktail, or was your intent to be like, no, this is a quality brandy, I want you to taste by itself?
The latter, but, okay. But if you want to put it in a cocktail,
sure.
I think that's great. And we do. But no, we wanted to make sipping brandies.
That's
they're all great in cocktails in their own ways. But the goal was to make something that was just gorgeous on its own. Yeah.
Well, this really is very flavorful. And I could think of a couple cocktails that would be good. But
I'd like to throw maybe half a shot into some champagne for New Year's. That's kind of become our tradition with this brandy.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That sounds really good.
Yeah.
All
it's
right.
Like a French Boilermaker.
Yeah. Jesus. All right. Taking notes.
Yeah.
So next is the cherry brandy.
Cherry brandy, yes. And so... same orchard, very similar process. We don't grind the cherries. They kind of, as they ferment and the weight of the cherries in the tank crushes the cherries on their own.
Okay.
Sort of a carbonic maceration. That just means like they're being crushed on their own and fermenting at different times. The pits fall to the bottom. So the pits in cherries contain a lot of cyanide, and you don't want to distill too many of them. So there's usually only like a handful of pits that come through the pump. They all settle to the bottom of the tank. In French and German speaking countries and other parts of Europe, that cyanide from the pits is a desirable characteristic because it gives almost like an almond kind of flavor. So if you're drinking something and you taste almond, there's probably some cyanide in it.
Jesus.
But not in ours. And this is, this year's is not 100% Montmorency cherries. We actually got about 60 gallons worth of cherries from some seedling cherry trees from my parents' property in Pennsylvania that they finally had a giant harvest this year. And so we were able to essentially forage some of those from probably 70-foot tall cherry trees. So this one is unique, and not sure if we'll be able to make this particular expression again. We'll continue to use the Montmorency. It's another heirloom cherry that's been around for literally hundreds of years. And it's a sour cherry, so it's got good acid. That helps our fermentation. We want a high acid environment so that we're not getting any infections from bugs or other bacteria. And
yes, that is, because you said you have some of this in a barrel too.
We do, yeah.
So I'm curious, because that's very, very good. I love cherries. I think that'd be very, I'd be curious about what the barrel adds to that.
We can try some later.
Okay, well, how dare you? Yeah. See, and I told you that I'm from Wisconsin, so we have
big brandy producing legacy. Yeah.
Yeah, tradition. Brandy producing, and also we take a third of the sales of Korbel.
Okay.
Which is not good brandy, but it's
so there's an element of education here. Because people haven't been exposed to good brandy, and when they hear brandy, they either conceive of, you know, some old guy drinking out of a snifter with a cigar, wearing velvet, or they think of something that's just super cloyingly sweet that is called brandy, but is more like a liqueur.
Yes.
That's made with sugar and some brandy. So there's not the same kind of adherence to, I don't want to call them rigorous, but standards for production of brandies in the U.S. as there is in other parts of the world, where a lot of the varieties of brandy made in France and Italy and other parts of Europe, they're protected categories, and they have very prescribed procedures, even down to the types of varieties or the varieties of fruit that you're allowed to use.
Is that because I know cognac is the same, is brandy and cognac the same thing? Is that a marketing thing for the United States, that it just brandy makes more sense to sell in a bottle? Because I could think of like, cognac, thanks to, for me, it makes like a premium.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, same way. It's a appellation. Okay. So it's a protected style of brandy from the cognac region of France. So same way as champagne. Calvados is from Normandy region of France. And even within that, there are different types of Calvados identities that they can put on a label. But each one has its own different standards and requirements.
Gotcha.
I just don't think at the state of brandy making in the United States right now that there's enough identity to protect. So we talked about federal regulations, but there are, they call them the standards of identity that describe what you can call a brandy, and they're not as proscriptive as some of the standards in Europe. So, for instance, apple brandy. People can call it Apple Jack. Laird's is the most famous. And it's essentially a carve-out in the language, in the law, for their product, which is an apple brandy-based spirit, their Apple Jack. Mm. But I could call my brandy, which is 100% apples, Applejack 2, but there's a difference. And the difference is, you know, Applejack as Laird's make it is 25% apple brandy, 75% neutral spirit, so essentially vodka. So it's an apple brandy flavored vodka.
I see.
Or apple brandy infused vodka, however you want to describe it. Those are kind of the two brandies that have any kind of protection, Applejack and apple brandy. The rest, yeah, I would love to have, you know, a mid-Atlantic group of brandy producers that used varieties that grow well or have historically grown well in the mid-Atlantic. I would love for there to be a New England apple brandy distinction or classification, a West Coast, a Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
We just don't have the number of producers and don't have the traditions that would need protection by giving them a particular name. There certainly is a branding capacity to something like a cognac. You know exactly what you're getting if you buy a bottle of cognac. Sure, there's better and worse within that category, but for the most part, you know what you're going to get, and it has a very there's a floor in quality that is protected because they want it protected, because they want to brand this as a luxury spirit. So there's a incentive to protect that category. I don't see it happening anytime soon in the US.
Yeah, brandy is one of those weird categories. Even in Wisconsin, I've noticed that, I mean, every distillery is making a brandy just because brandy. But I don't know. Bourbon owns the market right now.
Yeah.
And it's a sweet or whiskey, right? And a rye is trying to catch up a little bit. And hopefully that starts to break out more and more. But I could see a future where brandy starts to be the next brown liquor that pops off.
Yeah, people have to start growing more of the particular varieties of fruit that make good brandy.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the brandy that's made in the U.S. at small scale is just leftover either table fruit, if we're talking apples, dessert fruit.
Sure.
That, you know, you can get seconds for cheap at the end of the season. There are very few orchards, very few distilleries connected to orchards that are intentionally growing fruit that makes good brandy first, or good cider first. There are many more commercial orchards just growing fruit that's meant to be eaten fresh.
Right.
Yeah. And there's a big difference, world of differences between apples that make good cider and brandy and apples that are good to eat fresh. There are some that, you know, can kind of sit in both categories, but for the most part, apples that make good cider and brandy are bitter, acidic. They don't look good. they're not valuable in anything other than cider and brandy.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, cool. Well, those two brandies are phenomenal. And
thanks.
I love that. And I love the story behind them too. And I love that you're like fully embracing the fact that they're hard to work with because it's fruits are fruits.
Yeah. I remember reading something somewhere about someone who tried to do a fruit brandy 1 year, and they said they would never do it again because it was too sticky. I don't remember the exact quote. Like, yeah.
Like the floor?
It's fruit, yeah. Grain is a much easier ingredient to deal with from the perspective of production because you don't have to touch it. You don't have to transform it. You just kind of have to get it into a tank and let the water and your pumps and your paddles and your agitators do all the work.
Yeah.
Whereas fruit, yeah, it's a lot more effort.
Yep. Well, speaking of grain, should we move on to the rye?
Sure. Yeah. So this is our by far most popular spirit. About 3/4 of what we sell is our rye whiskey.
Okay.
It's probably also our most popular spirit at the bar, in the cocktail bar too. So this is, yeah, like I said, about 2/3 rye, and we use a particular variety called Abruzzi when we can get our hands on it. And 1/3 malted barley. We use a 2-row grown in Kemar, just outside of Frederick. I think I mentioned that.
Yep.
And we do kind of a sour mash and kind of a spontaneous fermentation.
Okay.
when the fermentation is going on in here, people... And we have people in on Thursdays and Fridays or Saturdays, and they ask us what that smell is because it smells like sourdough bread or a sourdough starter. And like, yeah, that's literally what we're doing. Probably at the expense of a little bit of alcohol production in the fermentation process, but that's fine for us. We're not chasing efficiency, we're chasing flavor. So this one goes into a new American oak barrel. I think that one's around 2 years.
It says, 23 months on the bottle.
Yeah, there you go. so kind of towards the latter end of when we like to leave things in the barrel. But yeah, we love it. We got a Good Food Award for that.
Yeah.
Last year. And it's not spicy like many people think of a rye. I get a lot more fruit and jam in there. And you know, I'm certain that's from our fermentation that we're doing kind of a fruity sourdough.
That's a very different rye.
Yeah.
And not in a bad way at all. I could probably line up 17 different ryes and tell you I love them all.
Yep.
But I love malted barley. And there's a little bit of a hint of that coffee and yes. chocolate note that
yes,
comes through.
That's exactly it. Yep.
And you said jam, and my neurons just lit up. It's yep. like, yeah, it's like a jammy, very sweet, sticky that is so good. Because I love a rye spice. I don't like a rye spice that's spicy to be spicy.
Yeah.
It's a little too much.
Yeah.
So good job.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, you nailed it. Those are exactly the same notes that I get on the palate. And that's pretty much the feedback we get across the board too.
Yeah.
Like chocolate, malt. Yeah. Yeah.
Are there many places, I don't think I've seen too many that are doing no corn, just supplementing the rye with a barley. I don't, or spelt.
So there's a distillery in Maine. I think they're called New England Distilling Company. They're close to, they're in Portland, and they make what they call a Maryland style rye. And it's I'm not exactly sure what their proportions are of rye to malted barley, but it's again just rye and malted barley. I'm not sure if Leopold's, they make a Maryland style rye, and they started doing a three chamber rye, which if you're not familiar with what that is, it's just a style of still that was prominent in the late 18th, early 19th century.
Okay.
In particular in rye producing distilleries. I would have to look to see if they publish what their grain bill is. But Leopold's and New England Distilling's rye are the closest thing to ours that I've seen on the market. They have very similar profiles.
Okay. Yeah, that to me that's super unique. With almost 90% of rye I've seen out there, it's rye with corn.
Yep.
So or
maybe
wheat.
A little bit of barley just for fermentation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really unique. I love that. I know it's your best seller. Did you expect that? Are you okay with that? Because you've been down on your brandy, and I'm curious what's your baby?
I did expect that.
Okay.
You know, the market for whiskey is much bigger, and people are familiar with whiskey.
Sure.
So even though it's a unique whiskey, it's still more accessible to people who have had rye whiskey or any kind of whiskey. The brandies, yeah, it's new, it's different. Well, not new, but different and new to some people. And the learning curve, I think, is just a little bit higher. And everyone knows what to do with whiskey and cocktails. Old fashioned, Manhattan, you know, a sour. Brandy, again, learning curve is a little bit steeper.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. That's fair. Well, hey, I mean, I think play of the market. I know you've said at some point you're going to make bourbon. So
right. Yeah.
And it's going to be good regardless.
Yeah.
And you know, the best part about that too, is that brings people in. Oh yeah. Whiskey. And then, oh, you make a pair of brandy.
Yep.
I want to try that. Word of mouth.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. So. Yeah. And usually if you start talking to me about our spirits, I'm on to our fruit brandies after the third or fourth word. So even if all you want to hear about is our rye whiskey or our whiskey and gins, I'm going to bring brandy into the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would be boring for me to come here and talk to you and be like, I only want to try your whiskey. It's less samples.
Yeah.
Cool. So what do we have next?
So next we have our Forage Citrus Gin. So this one, I love this. It's essentially our Dutch style gin, which, as I said, it's like an unaged whiskey with the botanicals. But this one uses a particular fruit called a trifoliate orange. And I'm sure you've never heard of this, but it grows around here. It's a citrus fruit that's cold hardy, frost tolerant. It was brought here from Asia for those characteristics and used as a rootstock because you could grow a tree that could survive if it went below freezing.
Okay.
This particular fruit is not super interesting on its own. And I just mean that from the sense of it's filled with these giant seeds. So you can't juice it. It's really small. It's only about the size, maybe half of a golf ball. It ripens for about a week. It's dark green on the tree until the very moment it's ripe, which is right about now, this time of year. And you got to get them, pick them before you have a freeze. Otherwise, they're no good. But all we're after is the oils and the skins. And it has a super unique aroma and flavor. And we just loved it. And it kind of fit really well with our approach to our other spirits. We found fruit that's growing locally that we can forage for, that we can use in our gin. And using dried orange peel, dried lemon peel, dried other citrus peels in gins, it's a common, very common botanical. But we thought it would be really awesome to have something that was growing around here.
So I'm not a gin person, and I've said that on every episode I've had, but I am increasingly encouraged by places that make gin that isn't that junipery pine sol Christmas tree.
Yep. This is not that.
No. That's very good. It's very different, very light.
Yeah.
Very delicate. There's a little bit of floral in there, but there's a lot of that citrus and that fruit note. I'd be curious to try one of those fruits by itself because I don't know what that is at all.
Okay. I'll pull one out for you.
Okay. Sweet. But yeah, that's so different. Have you thought about aging this at all?
So we did a combination of the citrus gin and our Dutch style gin in a barrel. And those are the last two bottles of that particular barrel.
Okay.
But we've got another one out there that I'll probably be emptying this week.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, that's very flavorful.
We use that one more so in a gin and tonic. It's a little bit drier than our Dutch style gin, and the citrus just pairs very really well with a lot of different cocktails too. Like we like that one in a martini with a twist.
Yeah. I could see that.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah, see, you're converting me. You're helping to convert me. So that's very good. So last but not least.
Okay, so you just asked. This is that gin that has some of the forged citrus and Dutch style that was in a used rye whiskey barrel, I think 2 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that one was super special. We did a bottling of that with some ceramic bottles that a local potter made for us. And those were super popular and went quickly.
I've noticed that barrel-aged gin has been kind of a hard sought-out thing that people want.
It satisfies both gin drinkers and whiskey drinkers. And it's got the sweetness from the barrel, and it's got, you know, just really cool combination of that citrus, the juniper, working with the oak. And you still get the grains that come through on there too.
Yeah.
Even at 2 years, even with the botanicals from the gin. Yeah.
The citrus is still there. It's a little bit more mellowed.
Yep.
And that wood sugar comes through.
Yeah.
It's like candy.
You got a good palate.
Yeah. Wow. Well, experience.
Yep. practice.
Yeah. Practice. Tell my wife it's practice.
Yeah.
You said that 2 years.
Yep.
Wow. Well. Phenomenal.
Yeah. another thing we learn the longer our spirits are in barrels, man, they evaporate much, much more quickly with a more, with greater surface area to volume than they would in a larger barrel. So, yeah.
I know you made mention earlier that you're looking to expand and go to a different spot.
Yep.
Is the plan down the road to get to like a 53 gallon barrel to play with that kind of stuff? Or?
I think so. I think so. Yeah. And I will not be lifting that with my back. We will have forklifts. This is a humble, small distillery, 1,000 square feet. Since day one, we were out of room, and we had been looking in earnest about 3 years ago. 2 or 3 years ago, we started looking for additional production space, and we were really looking in some of the industrial areas around here and just kind of focused on a warehouse that we can have 20-foot ceilings, a big garage door, and put in bigger equipment and then keep this spot as just our cocktail bar.
Okay.
That search process, it was a long process, but we found a building in Tacoma Park, which is where I live, and it's in a very similar kind of commercial strip. It's an old bank, and we had worked with a local broker to find that building, got under contract, went through the paperwork of the SBA's loan programs to be able to purchase the building. We wanted our own if we were going to put any kind of the infrastructure upgrades that, that, you know, would be necessary for any building probably, but in particular that building. The goal is to move 95% of our production from Hyattsville to Tacoma Park. Okay. And we'll keep some stuff here so we can have kind of our experimental still, or a Hyattsville specific release of something super special and unique. We'll get bigger equipment for Tacoma Park, a bigger still, more capacity in fermentation. And yeah, we'll have a lot more room to age barrels. It's about a 10,000 square foot building, 5,000 on first level and basement. And we'll take most of that basement for barrel aging. That will change things too, because it will not be exposed to the temperature changes like our current aging setup is. And so there will be some degree of experimentation. And yeah, I think we would move to bigger barrels, not just to see how that affects the process, but also it kind of is an efficiency thing. If we can buy a 53-gallon barrel for $250 or however much they're going for now, and a 15-gallon barrel for $220, yeah, it just makes financial sense. And yeah, we'll have the capacity and the capability to do it.
Very cool. Well, I look forward to that. That's awesome. Is there anything else that we can look forward to from Sang Froid?
Mentioned the two pear brandy and cherry brandy in barrels. We have a single malt whiskey that we're sitting on. I think we're going to try a persimmon brandy this year. We were just able to secure a whole bunch of persimmons. We've never worked with persimmons before, and I've never even worked with them kind of on a hobby level before. So this will be a first for us. And find me a persimmon brandy somewhere else, and there might be a handful in the world. So that'll be cool. And there's also a local cidery, Ancho, that's going to be experimenting with some persimmon infused cider. So kind of two of us doing it at the same time, and we'll see what happens.
Well, very cool. Yeah, well, keep me in the loop on that, because I love persimmons on their own, just as a snack. So, and alcohol and food just works together.
Yeah, but, I mean, there's a whole bunch of, you know, wild native persimmons that grow around here. So I think these persimmons are an Asian variety. And I think I'm gonna go, because they're just about ready right now, the ones on the trees. They're much more stringent than the Asian varieties. Asian varieties are super sweet. So I might just get a couple gallons of those just to see what that will do to the flavor.
Just play with it.
And then I can say it's got some local foraged fruit in there too. So yeah,
that's very cool.
Yep.
Well, Jeff, I love what you're doing here.
You got
the small, quaint little, you know, craft operation you're working on, and you're, you know, only up from here. So
yeah. Thanks for coming out and visiting.
Of course. Thanks for sharing your story and your spirits. They're delicious. And I look forward to sharing this with my friends and family, and I'll bring one of these bottles home and
all right,
taste it.
But, French Boilermaker.
Yes. No, it's a mental note. I made it. But no, I appreciate you having me here, and I'll be
my
in
pleasure.
Touch. I appreciate it.
Yep. So, excellent.
Cheers.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd appreciate it if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. The more reviews, the easier we are to find. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow us on social media so you never miss any of our updates. Be sure to share this episode with your friends, and always be sure to drink responsibly. There are quite literally thousands of distilleries, so we're just getting started. Stay tuned for more conversations with master distillers, distillery owners, mixologists, and even bar owners, and more. Cheers.